The Vegan Vegetarian Solutions for a Sustainable Environment podcast is a project consisting of many authors striving to shine a bright light on the major step the world must take if we ever want to attain a sustainable environment. That step is to dramatically reduce, if not completely eliminate, animals as a food source from our diets. In other words, adapting a vegan, vegetarian lifestyle. The podcast show notes can be found at h2opodcast.com and by clicking the vegetarian link or by emailing nomeat@h2opodcast.com.
This is Ray Sikora, and I have the pleasure being able to interview Richard Schwartz today. For those of you who don't know Richard's work, I'll tell you a little bit about him. Richard is the associate producer of the documentary A Sacred Duty, and I highly recommend this film. It is incredible. The film is about applying Jewish values to helping to heal the world, and we'll definitely talk more about that in this show. He's also Professor Emeritus at the College of Staten Island. He is the President of the Jewish Vegetarians of North America. He's the Director of the Vegetarian Climate Alliance. He's the author of Judaism and Vegetarianism, Judaism and Global Survival, and over 140 articles that you can find at jewishveg.com/Schwartz. So, Richard, are you there?
I am, and thank you very much for that very kind introduction, and it's a privilege to be working with you, and I want to commend you for the many, many years of great work you have been doing promoting vegetarianism and animal rights.
You and I have both chosen a path of doing this kind of service work, and I think we both know how rewarding that is.
Absolutely.
Well, what I want, for those who don't know you, I want to get a little background on you. Your life, as long as I've known you, has been dedicated to this work. So first I want to find out what it is that you think just attracted you to this path. You know, we have things in our life that we either move toward or we move away from, things that mold who we are and how we end up living on the earth. So could you tell a little bit about what you think were the turning points in your life map that made you turn toward this type of focus?
Okay, one major turning point was I was giving a course at the College of Staten Island for liberal arts, non-science students, and mathematics, and suddenly hit me out. They're weak in math. They're poorly prepared, poorly motivated. So I came up with this idea of giving a course on mathematics and the environment, sort of relating all the math concepts and examples to the environment. And one year we were focusing on world hunger, and at first I thought, well, you know, it's a shame so many people are chronically hungry out there. Maybe there's just too many people, etc. But then I read this wonderful book by Francis Moore Pay, I'm sure you're familiar with, called Diet for a Small Planet, pointing out how wasteful animal-based diets are actually. You know, that we're actually feeding 70% of the grain produced in the U.S., for example, to animals destined for slaughter. Well, an estimated 20 million people are dying of hunger and its effects every year worldwide. So that was a starting point. And the more I got into it, you know, first we had discussions, and I pointed out that, you know, we could reduce hunger if there was a shift toward plant-based diets. And finally, a year or two later, I took my own advice. And then I started looking into it more and more. And I've always thought that the most important thing with religion is applying it to problems and all. You know, Judaism has much to say about the issues of the world. And I started looking into connections, and that led me to write the first edition of my book. It came out in 1982, actually, Judaism and Vegetarianism. And the more I got into it, the more connections I saw from the Jewish perspective, but also from the general perspective. And that's why I'm happy in this program that we'll be able to get into why people in general religious or not, should be vegetarians.
It's so great. You know, your path was so largely influenced by a book. A book mm-hmm. that you read that started you mm-hmm. in a whole different direction. And now what you've done is that you've taken the knowledge that you've gained since that book influenced you, and you are putting out educational materials, books and film and articles that are doing the same for people. You know, and Frances Moore LePay, I'm guessing that she doesn't know how she influenced mm-hmm. your path. And so I'm really thinking how
probably
amazing
not.
It is that there are so many people who you are influencing every day, and you don't know it. There's no way that you are aware of how many people.
That's true. Every once in a while, you find out somebody does write to you and indicate how their life was influenced. So you do find out once in a while, but I'm sure maybe there's many others. And you know, I've often said teaching is a very good profession. You know, I was doing that for many years. Of course, you never know who you're influencing. You know, a teacher
exactly.
affects eternity. You affect one person who may affect others, and it goes on and on. So I
yes,
think that's
exactly.
your role and my role to try to teach people to get the messages out there and hope that it will create ripples that will widen and widen and affect more and more people.
Exactly. Yeah, I know that you have. I'm guessing that, you know, only a very small percentage of the people who you have had a positive influence on have contacted you. So there are all these people mm-hmm. you've planted, all these seeds. So that's
mm-hmm.
making me smile right now when I think about it. I love it. I love that you've had that influence. I'm sure that a lot of people listening don't have the full scope of why someone would choose a vegetarian or vegan diet. You know, we all come to it from different paths. For me,
mm-hmm.
it was compassion and nonviolence. For some people, it's the environment. For some people, it's health. You know, everybody's
mm-hmm.
coming at it from, you know, these different, slightly
right.
different angles.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if you can just tell us just the sort of main points, like why would someone choose this path?
Okay, I've sort of put together eight reasons. I'm sure there are many more. As you say, people come from different directions. So I want to just outline these eight, and then I'll be happy to discuss each one in a little bit of detail.
Great.
And, you know, everybody has priorities, which is most important. So I'll just list the eight, and people can decide which is most important for them. Well, of course, the first is compassion for animals, because animals are very badly treated on factory farms. Second, that the most important thing a person can do for their own health is to adopt a plant-based diet. And also, this has secondary effects because medical costs have been soaring, creating budget deficits and causing cutting back of many vital services. So shifting to vegetarian diet for health reasons can have many positive effects. Third, and one that's becoming more and more important, is the environmental connection. And related to that is climate change, perhaps the greatest threat to humanity today. I want to discuss a little later the strong connections between animal-based diets and agriculture and climate change. And then a fifth reason is a very wasteful use of water, energy, other resources. Sixth is that it's really scandalous that there's so much hunger out there, and meanwhile we're feeding so much grain to the animals, so hunger is a sixth issue. Seven is one, and we'll need a little more explanation about perhaps later, but the connection to violence and greater potential for war because of animal-based diets. And an eighth is the very, very horrible conditions for workers on factory farms and in slaughterhouses. So these are eight, and you might want to add some if you wish.
Oh, I'll bet I'll be adding all kinds of things while we have an hour
right.
together here, however long we have together.
Yeah, right.
You know, a lot of people, you probably have experienced this, that a lot of people, when you're sharing these reasons, think that you're being negative or you're the bearer of bad news or,
mm-hmm.
You know, oh, come on, let's just have a good time, lighten up. And I know I've experienced it. I'm sure you have. And so what I hear in these points that you're making is that people need the background information. They need to know the realities of what's going on in the industry and what the effects are of making these choices. Once they have the information, then the positive step comes where we can invite them to take this very, very positive step toward making a difference as an individual. So for anyone who's listening who thinks, oh, this is just going to be like the, you know, the dark, down, depressing podcast, it's not. This is the reality that people need in order to know the realities, and this is the realities that hopefully motivate people. And so so I'd like to go a little bit more into some of the points that you brought up. And let's start with how the animals are treated. I think that most people are not aware of the realities behind closed doors and gates. So tell some of your experience and your research into that.
Right. Yeah, and you know, Paul McCartney once said if slaughterhouses had glass walls, everybody would be a vegetarian. So as you point out, there's a lot hidden out there, and thank God there have been some great groups that have shown underground footage that really have shown what's happening. So it's really horrible. You know, we're talking about 10 billion animals raised for food every year in the U.S., 60 billion worldwide, most of them in a factory farm conditions, you know, cramped spaces, all the natural instincts being thwarted. Now, one example is in the egg-laying industry. And there's an amazing thing because 250 million chicks are killed almost immediately after birth. And this is because these are male chicks, can't lay eggs, and they haven't been genetically programmed like so-called broiler chickens have to produce much flesh. So they are just destroyed right away, often just put into plastic bags to suffocate or ground up, possibly for pet food or fertilizer. And unfortunately, the females, the hens, don't fare that much better because they are put, along with maybe six, seven other hens, very small cages, so small that they can't even raise a wing. You know, more than natural instincts thwarted, natural pecking order thwarted. So because of this, often they end up pecking at other hens, harming them, sometimes killing them. And the industry, mainly concerned about profit, how to fatten up the birds as quickly as possible, etc., instead of providing more space, which would reduce their profits, they end up with a very cruel process of debeaking these birds, you know, without any anesthesia or anything. So
I'm going to play the devil's advocate here, fellow vegan, but I'm going to play devil's advocate because I know what many people are probably thinking hearing this. I mean, certainly with how the males are discarded, that is true in any facility, whether they call themselves organic, free-range, cage-free, any of those, they don't have a use for the males. But in terms of the crowded cages, you know, can't I just go and buy free-range or cage-free eggs and then feel good about it?
Okay, well, unfortunately, the definition and the inspection for that is not all that great, and the conditions aren't that bad. As you say, the males are killed, which alone is pretty bad. Very often, you know, when they say free range, it means there's a small opening and the birds are free to go outside for a while, but it still has very, very negative effects and all. So, I mean, the ideal, if somebody's really compassionate, you know, and most people really are in terms of dogs and cats and all, and as you say, they just don't think about it that much and not aware of the conditions. So certainly free range can be a step forward, but it still involves a lot of cruelty. And again, there's so much in every phase of it. You know, production of eggs, we said, a lot of cruelty. The same thing with milk. You know, they talk about contented cows, the industry does, and, you know, they mislead people, but the dairy cows are artificially impregnated every single year so they can continue to give milk. Babies are taken away right away. The females grow up and possibly give milk later. And the males are taken away to be raised often as veal, very small confined spaces, given a diet devoid of iron, so they don't have that special white look that and taste that people want. So again, very negative, and you know, no matter which area you look at, pâté de foie gras, for example, means the forcing of grain down the throats of animals. So
yeah.
Certainly, there's very, very negative conditions under which animals are raised. So that is one important reason people want to be compassionate. Certainly can have a very nutritious diet, many plant products, no need for animal products.
Great. You know, you have probably experienced this, that most people consider themselves animal lovers. I love animals.
Yeah, sure.
You hear it all the time. When I ask people, oh, who are the animals who you love?
Mm-hmm.
Are there certain species who you love?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's generally the ones who they have shared their homes with or who they've gotten to meet one-on-one, you know, dogs, cats, maybe horses.
Yeah.
And others are left out of this sort of circle of compassion, this circle of caring. So I'm wondering in this, I think it's one of the hardest ones. It's to get people to care about those, even to care about humans who aren't in their immediate circle.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you suggest that we somehow build that bridge to get people to care how all animals are treated, not just the ones that they share their homes with?
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, one thing is to increase awareness of what really is happening there in factory farms. You know, very often we go in a supermarket, everything is nicely wrapped in cellophane, and the connection just isn't made. So I think we just have to get that message out more and more, of course, in a very respectful way, to have dialogues and not to make people feel guilty, et cetera, but just, like you say, you know, to have a conversation, ask, well, what animals do you love, et cetera, and mm-hmm. somehow get them to realize that other animals also have feelings, of course, are sensitive, of course, feel pain as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there are so many ways to do it, and I love the ways that you educate and invite people to do it. And, you know, I think that personal stories are just a really wonderful way, and just
mm-hmm.
telling about, you know, certain animals, telling about individuals, because it's very easy to write off a whole culture, whether it's a whole culture of humans or a whole species. It's very easy to go, oh, yeah, that group, and not
mm-hmm.
think about the individuals in that group, you know, the dairy cows who you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
With dairy cows, you know, my own reason for quitting any sort of dairy products in my diet and really making that choice very quickly without ever having heard the word vegan or thinking about plant-based or anything
mm-hmm.
was meeting the individuals, was coming to a dairy farm on the day that those males were being taken away,
mm-hmm.
and some of them were wet and wobbly, and I heard a sound that was so horrible, and I went behind the
mm-hmm.
barn, and it was the mothers,
right.
who their mouths were wide open, bellowing, trying to get to their babies,
yeah,
and
yeah.
some were pressed against the barbed wire, and blood was coming down their chest, and for me, it changed everything. I saw these
mm-hmm.
individuals, and I thought, this just isn't right, that they're babies would be taken away so we could drink their milk, which
mm-hmm.
is meant for those babies who are going off to a veal facility.
Mm-hmm.
So it's so hard because I want to give that direct experience to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as you say, education is the key. And that's what we're trying to do, I think, is how do I give this experience and share this experience with everyone, the glass walls that you're talking
mm-hmm.
about.
There's also some very wonderful children's books. You know, every child goes to bed with their pet stuffed animals, et cetera, and
mm-hmm.
love that. And so I think we can get people to read some of the wonderful books out there that give an idea about many wonders of animals and how poorly they're treated. That can also be a helpful
yes.
factor.
Yeah, that is such a good point, just starting people young.
Young,
you know, when they're young, to help them realize that they're part of this big family. They're part
mm-hmm.
of a big animal family that, you know, everything starts to train us when we're young that we're separate from other species.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's animals and then there's us. And,
right.
And many children don't even realize we are animals. And, you know, we're taught from such a young age that we're not in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so to try and bring them back to that connection at as early an age as possible is so important.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Then, of course, there's many other reasons that, like the health reason, for example. And this,
yeah,
this is really incredible. You know, there's so much now, and I'm just reading in the local paper, they want to cut senior citizen centers, they want to cut programs for jobs for people and all that, you know, because we have these budgetary problems. And medical costs have been soaring, and we can prevent so many of these diseases and all. You know, there's so many, cancer, the heart attacks, diabetes, so many diseases have been very strongly connected to animal-based diets. And unfortunately, the medical profession is not educated in terms of this nutrition and all. They may just get a course or two, sometimes it's optional, and they just talk about a well-balanced diet. They don't go into the tremendous evidence that's involved here, showing the links between these chronic degenerative diseases and animal-based diets. And I think people should become aware there's two very important studies that I think could change the world in a way. You're familiar with it? Dr. Dean Ornish's study, where he showed that heart disease could actually be reversed on a good, well-balanced, plant-based diet. And he had a control group that has followed the recommendations of the American Medical Association, you know, 30% fat. You can eat chicken, just take off the skin, et cetera, et cetera. You can have some fish. Those people all got worse, but all the people who changed to pretty much a vegan diet, along with some exercise, meditation, talking things out, et cetera, they got far better. So here's something that not only can we prevent many diseases, we can actually reverse them. Then there's that very, very important so-called China Cornell Oxford study, something done in China, and this was called by the New York Times the Grand Prix of Epidemiology. It was such a big epidemiological study, and it showed that the more animal products in the diet, the more disease. And, you know, by just going from village to village in China where they had different amounts of animal products in their diet, and so this should be brought out. And I just want to mention there's two very important myths that I think keep people away from switching to vegetarianism. And these are the protein myth and the calcium myth. You know, how often have you been asked, how do you get your protein? What's your source of protein? You know, I think it was Neil Barnard, the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, mentioned, you know, it's almost like the fourth color of the American flag. It's red, white, blue, and protein. You know, so much emphasis on that. And the amazing thing is, as he points out and others, it's almost impossible on a good, well-balanced diet not to get enough protein.
Exactly.
And where we went wrong is that the initial experiments were on rats, and a rat's mother's milk has about 47% of its calories in protein, but a human mother's milk only 5%.
Exactly.
So most people are getting far too much, especially animal protein, and this is very bad for the kidneys, major cause of cancer, and also, surprising to most people when I tell them, really a major, major cause of osteoporosis.
Yes.
So that's that protein myth that most people get too much rather than not enough. And tying in with the calcium myth, the amazing thing, you know, the milk industry, one of the biggest scams with the milk mustaches and everything, claiming that we need plenty of milk to avoid osteoporosis. And yet, as you know, the countries with the most osteoporosis, like the U.S., Scandinavian countries, for example, these are countries where they have the most dairy products.
Yes.
In countries like China, where the lactose intolerance, they have far less. And the reason for that ties in with that protein, because the human body cannot absorb excess protein. It's going to be excreted. But before that happens, it acidifies the blood. And to buffer and neutralize that, the body needs calcium. there's not enough in the blood. It's taken from the bones and excreted along with the excess protein. So really amazing, these two myths about protein and calcium, and actually getting a lot of milk and animal products is very, very negative for people's health.
I think a lot of the reason that those myths are perpetuated is that it's part of the education process. You know, if you go into a school or if you go into a doctor's
mm-hmm.
office and you say,
yeah.
can I please get some nutritional information? If you look
mm-hmm.
at who provides that
yeah,
nutritional
sure.
information, it's
yeah.
the dairy council or the beef industry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who is providing the information? You know, so often when people ask me that question, you know, oh, where do you get your protein? You know, I would,
mm-hmm.
you know, I would really worry about protein. You know, we don't have people in this country who are walking around protein deficient. You know,
right.
there's a name for that. It's kwashiorkor or something.
Right.
And there aren't people like that. And people say to me, well, you know, I can't be vegan or vegetarian because I don't like tofu. And I say,
mm-hmm.
why do you think you need to eat tofu?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, for
protein. Yeah.
And I say, wow, you know, you could eat mushrooms, broccoli. Those
yeah.
all have more than 5%
yeah.
protein in them.
Spinach has almost 50%.
Exactly, exactly. You know, whereas, you know, human mother's milk for the time of the most growth
right.
is that 5% that you talked about.
Right.
You know, so, yeah, so it's definitely, you're right, those myths are such an issue. And now there are all these world-class athletes
right.
who are really debunking those myths because these world-class athletes are doing it on a plant-based diet.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can't look at that and say, oh, wait a minute, we need protein or, you know, from meat. Or, it's great. Or you look at an elephant, you know, or
mm-hmm.
any of the large herbivores.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Same thing.
Where are
a
they
cow.
Getting their protein? Yeah.
yeah. How
yeah.
about, let's talk about the environment, because I know this is an area of expertise for you. And I love that you use the words climate change instead of global warming. Most
mm-hmm.
of the time I hear you say climate change. And it's very easy for people to sort of say, oh, there is no global warming because, you know, it's
mm-hmm.
10 below zero this week
yeah,
or
yeah.
whatever. You know, so global warming has really confused people calling it that. But climate change
Absolutely.
Is something that doesn't confuse people as much.
Mm-hmm.
So talk a little bit about that, the environmental effects and climate
mm-hmm.
change.
Right. By the way, talking about terminology, two other expressions I've heard which may really hit things very well. Somebody, this Arthur Waskow, the environment quite a bit, says we shouldn't say global warming. It sounds nice, you know, you warm up a little bit in the winter. And all. He says we should call it global scorching, you know, which really hits a little bit better. And
yeah.
somewhere else I read, they said not just global warming, but global weirding, in a way, because we're getting weird, weird weather. Just looking at the news, as we speak last night, talking about tremendous flooding in New Jersey. And there's been tremendous floods in Pakistan, China, Australia recently. So actually,
yeah.
this is a very important. I'm glad you brought this up because I think this is the number one challenge, the biggest threat to the world. It looks like, unfortunately, we are heading toward an unprecedented climate catastrophe. Last year, 2010, was the warmest year tied, actually. 2005, the warmest year in recorded history. The way it was also the wettest year. And we can get into that in a little while. And the last decade was the warmest. You know, a lot of people, as you mentioned, you know, 10 degrees down or whatever, automatically say, so where's your global warming? And a lot of people confuse the terms weather, which really involves day-to-day, and that can change quite a bit. You know, you can get heavy rain one day, and if somebody from Mars came down, they think, gee, it's a very wet planet, and or another day or another week, it can be very dry. So that is the weather. But the climate is the long-term trends. And that is where it's been warming and warming each decade. For the last 4 or 5 decades, it's been getting warmer and warmer. One really astounding thing is that this past July in Russia, it was 14 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than the norm. Think of that, 14 degrees Fahrenheit. And many, many countries had record temperatures and well, heat waves all over. So we are already seeing the effects of climate change. A lot of people tell me, well, maybe it's a problem, but it's 50 years, 100 years, maybe our children, grandchildren will have to worry about it, but it's really hitting now. The glaciers are melting, the polar ice sheets are melting, and they're melting far faster than the worst-case projections of climate scientists. Some have called this the century of drought. There's droughts in many areas, and many other places, tremendous storms, because, you know, when things warm up, there's more moisture evaporating, so when we do have storms, they become more severe, and even in winter, you know, we can't say we're never going to have snow, nor we're going to have some snow, and it could be more severe storms like we had in many areas of the country this winter because of more moisture in the atmosphere and because things are changing in the polar areas. It's like vortexes being started. So actually even the heavier snowfall is an indication of climate change. And, of course, recently there's been tremendous amounts of wildfires. The governor of California, or former Governor Schwarzenegger, pointed out that the wildfire season in California used to be a few months a year. Now it's all year round. So there's been very, very heavy wildfires. Israel just experienced the worst in their history near Haifa last year. So all of these indicators, storms, there's been many more severe storms like Katrina recently and tornadoes, many, many indications. Now, one thing that's very significant is all of these special climatic effects have been due to a change of a little more than 1 degree Fahrenheit. And the most respected group on this, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which won the Nobel Peace Prize along with Al Gore a couple of years ago, they project an increase of anywhere from 2 to 11 degrees Fahrenheit in the next century. And by now, unfortunately, the 2 or 3 is very unlikely. You know, it could be 4. So there could be very severe warming, climate change in the next years unless we really turn things around. And unfortunately, there's so much climate denial out there, but so much has to be done, and we don't have that much time. One of the most important climate scientists, James Hansen from NASA, states that we could be very close to a tipping point where things can spin out of control and with very disastrous consequences in terms of climate change. And I wanted to get a little bit into the dietary connection because a lot of people say, well, it's a problem. What can we do about it? Very few realize the very strong connection to animal-based agriculture. Now, here's an amazing report, not from people for the ethical treatment of animals or an environmental group, from the UN Food and Agriculture Organization in 2006. A report called Livestock's Long Shadow. They pointed out an amazing, amazing thing that if you think of all the many, many, many cars in this world and planes and ships and trains, all the means of transportation combined worldwide, think of all the emissions from all these means of transportation, and they pointed out that animal agriculture emits more greenhouse gases in CO2 equivalents than all these means of transportation combined.
Exactly.
And more recently, a cover article in World Watch magazine in November-December issue of 2009, two environmentalists did a study, and they indicated that the UN FAO report was actually being conservative, and that at least, according to the estimate, taking all the factors of the livestock industry into account, the livestock sector, they reported, is responsible for at least 51% of all human-induced greenhouse gases, which is really an amazing, amazing thing. And this is largely due to the fact that animals give off a lot of methane in their digestive and excretion processes, and methane is, if you look at it in 20-year periods, because it has a relatively short half-life, it's 70 times 72 times as potent as carbon dioxide in causing warming. So this is a very important fact, and more and more people coming out this way. Even Al Gore, though unfortunately not the full vegetarian yet, has stated that people should eat less meat, and a lot of other important people have been stating that, because if we don't solve the climate crisis, everything else will be relatively minor, so everything possible has to be done, and shifting diet can have this major, major effect right away. So hope that message will get out there.
I think one of the issues is that for people to make changes in their lives, mm-hmm. it often takes a personal crisis. And
yeah.
that doesn't even do it sometimes. I've seen people come out of triple bypass surgery mm-hmm. and eat a steak.
Yeah.
You know, so
we'll start smoking again, right?
Exactly. So, you know, I think that what happens...
Well, isn't this partly the fault of the medical profession who,
yeah.
who doesn't make it very clear to people that one of the reasons they had that triple bypass was because of their diet? This, what I say
yes,
is, unfortunately, very often medical practice today is really malpractice. If doctors do not stress to people the importance of dietary changes, people may not listen, but at least they've done their part, you know.
Exactly.
So,
but you know what I think happens, Richard? I think
yep.
that people assume I can do whatever I want, whether it's to the environment or my own body, and the experts
mm-hmm.
are going to take care of it.
Yep.
I don't have the power to do something about it. That's not in my power. And I think that we're just trained that way instead of thinking,
mm-hmm.
oh, I can take control of my choices
right.
for
mm-hmm.
my body. I have as much power as anyone else
mm-hmm.
to do things in my lifestyle that are going to have a positive effect in the world and for the planet. But we're not a very empowered species that way. You know, we think, oh, we'll leave it to those experts and they're going to clean
mm-hmm.
up our messes. You know, we're not used to being responsible in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And
I
think
agree,
that's
100%.
Really, really common. You know, I was doing a talk for the Rotary Club, and
mm-hmm.
this man said, what you're talking about is so drastic, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And I said, which part is drastic? And he said, this plant-based diet, plant-based
yeah,
choices.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
I said, I know that it sounds very extreme because it's not familiar.
Mm-hmm.
But the alternative is much more extreme. And these were mostly
mm-hmm.
men in their 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you are all at an age where you're at a high risk for strokes, heart disease, all of it. So I took them through two scenarios. One was having a heart attack and having open heart surgery. I took
mm-hmm.
them through every step. I did like a visualization.
Mm-hmm.
I had them close their eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Took them through that. Then I said, okay, now scenario two, and I took them through that,
mm-hmm.
which was just sitting down to
mm-hmm.
plant-based meals three times a day. And I
mm-hmm.
took them through the details of both of these scenarios, and I said, which one seems more drastic, a knife
yeah,
cutting
yeah.
into your chest
mm-hmm.
or sitting down to beautiful plant-based meals,
mm-hmm.
which seems drastic?
Absolutely.
And this guy got it. He said, I get it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he got it. But I think
mm-hmm.
that it does sound drastic to people at first because
sure.
there are social pressures.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people want to fit in.
Absolutely.
And they want to do what their
people
usual familiar is.
Creatures of habit.
Yeah.
Now, I use an analogy with the metric system. And everybody knows the metric system, of course, is far more logical. Everything is based on 10,
yes.
you know.
Yes.
If it's kilograms or kilometers or kilowatts, you know, it's 1,000, et cetera. And
exactly.
we have all, but so why can't the U.S. change to that metric system? You know, people are just creatures of habits that it's hard to make these changes. And the same thing with the diet. If somebody was brought up on a plant-based diet and then told, you know, and there's another possible diet, we can take all these billions of animals and put them in pens and give them antibiotics and hormones and all kinds of things, and then we take them to the slaughterhouse, and by the way, we're going to use a tremendous amount more energy, and it's going to cause pollution of all types, and all the tremendous
yeah.
amount of manure is going to pollute our waters and all. And, you know, I think they kind of think they were crazy, but people are creatures of habit, as you say, and conformity, and people just don't want to know. Like you mentioned that documentary of ours, I can't tell you how many people just don't want to see it, especially the parts that show how animals are raised in factory farms and how they're slaughtered. So that's why the job is difficult, but it's the most important thing that people can do to help spread that message, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Now, another important factor that most people are not aware of, and this is why more and more I'm saying, it's not just an individual choice. The switch to plant-based diets is really a societal imperative. I've been saying it's really madness and insanity when you consider all the negative effects of animal-based diets. So another major factor is how very inefficient it is in the use of resources, how wasteful it is. And we mentioned it's a century of drought. The aquifers are being depleted. We're overpumping in terms of water. So many people are living in areas chronically short of water. And yet, really incredible that a person on a typical animal-based diet is using roughly 14 times as much water as a person on a strictly vegan diet. That's 4,200 gallons a day compared to 300 gallons a day. So it's so wasteful, and of course, people are talking more and more, running out of oil, and now, of course, with the turmoil in the Middle East, the oil prices are going up and all that. But so animal-based diets are so very inefficient. It can take maybe 10 times as much energy on an animal-based diet than a plant-based diet. It takes about 20 times as much land because, instead of just taking the fruits and the vegetables directly, we grow the grains in order to feed the animals. So, an amazing thing, 70% of the grain produced in the U.S. and over a third of the grain produced worldwide fed to animals destined for slaughter. Such a wasteful, inefficient process. And what makes it more insane is we take a wonderful, healthy product, soy, corn, other grains, very high in fiber, complex carbohydrates, and we feed them to animals, creating a product that is pretty much devoid of complex carbohydrates and fiber.
Yeah.
And create a product very high in saturated fat and in cholesterol. So, that's madness and sheer insanity related to the water shortages, energy shortages, widespread hunger, at a time when an estimated 20 million people are dying of hunger and its effects every single year. And the same UN Food and Agriculture Organization estimates that close to 1 billion people, almost 1 in 7 of the world's people, is chronically hungry. So, hope we can get these facts out, and
yeah,
mentioned at the beginning about the negatives, but I think there's the positives. If somebody switches a plant-based diet, it can be very positive. They can know that they're doing the most important thing they can possibly do for animals, for their own health, for the environment, for reducing climate change, for using resources efficiently, and for helping hungry people.
Yeah, it's such a logical choice. And even with that, I think that there are even people who make the choice, they have made the leap, and they say, okay, I'm going to be vegetarian or I'm going to be vegan. And then sometimes they slip back. That is how easy it is to go into denial about the health and environmental and animal issues related to it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's also, I think, really important for people, once they have made that choice, to surround themselves with supportive resources and supportive people so that they'll stay plugged in to this very healthy, compassionate choice. If they don't have other people around them who are exploring similar issues or who care like they care, it's very easy to slip back into, I think it's okay, I can go back to this now. And
right. And that's why some of the wonderful conferences that I know that you generally attend and speak at are so important, like the North American Vegetarian Society, SummerFest, and Farm Animal Rights movements, annual animal rights conferences, and so many others. You know, because you meet so many similar-minded people, and you hear talks that reinforce all the concepts. And of course, there's been some wonderful literature out there. Thank God for Veg News, wonderful publication. By the way, I'm just looking, preparing for this discussion. The last issue had a very powerful article called Injustice for All, and it points out something that is often overlooked, the horrible, horrible conditions that workers on factory farms and slaughterhouses experience. It's one of the most dangerous jobs. The turnover is very, very rapid. The accident rate is very high. And of course, what's happening is, to maximize profit, there's a speed up more and more, and sometimes less and less workers. Often many of them are immigrants, sometimes undocumented workers, so they feel they can't really complain that much, but really horrible, horrible conditions. And that is another important reason for it. By the way, a lot of people think in terms of vegetarianism, it's only good for the animals, but it's certainly also very positive for people to reduce these abuses on the factory farms, and it's positive for people's health, of course. It's positive for the environment, and we all want to live in a cleaner, healthier environment, and it's certainly better for hungry people as well.
You know what I think is wonderful in this point that you just brought up, which is that you cannot tease these apart. You know, somebody might call themselves an environmentalist. Mm-hmm. Another person might say, well, you know, I'm an animal rights person. Another person might say, well, I'm a human rights person. You know, this is what I care about. And we like to think of those as separate, and you cannot tease them apart. They're so interconnected. When I care about the environment, I'm also caring about people, and I'm caring about other species. And, you know, any of these issues that you look at, you know, if you look at the issue of, you know, the health issues, wow, it helps everyone. It helps the environment. You know, the fewer people who are going into hospitals are an environmental nightmare. You know, so the fewer people, it's also helping animals if people aren't needing these drugs and procedures that are often tested on other species. You know, so that just the interconnectedness of making these healthy choices is
absolutely
so important.
Everything is connected to everything else. And that's one other issue that people often overlook, and that is a connection to violence, terrorism, war, for example. So the reason I bring this up is, first of all, the Jewish sages noted that the Hebrew words for bread, which is lechem, and war, milchama, come from the same root, and they deduced from that that when there's a shortage of grain and other resources, people are more likely to go to war. When there's a shortage, you know, if there's more than enough, then people can say, well, they're taking more than their share, but we have enough, so not worth really getting bothered about. So this has been shown in history way back in the biblical days when there were battles over water in the wells, and more recently battles related to oil. So the fact that animal-based diets are so wasteful, rain and water, energy, other resources, makes it more likely for people to go to war. And that's why I come up with this idea that the slogan of the vegetarian movement and the slogan of the peace movement should be one and the same. Yeah. And here it is, based on a song by John Lennon. All we're saying is give peas a chance. What has been happening is, we're talking about climate change in addition to everything else. There was a report, I think it was 2007, by 11 retired U.S. generals and admirals, indicating that actually climate change is like a multiplier effect for terrorism and war, because there's going to be, unfortunately, perhaps millions and millions of refugees fleeing wildfires and droughts and floods and storms, heat waves. And these are going to be hungry, thirsty, desperate people. And that is going to make instability, violence, terrorism, and war more likely. And we're even seeing one example of that is in Darfur in Sudan. Now, everything is more involved and complicated, but one of the main factors was a major drought there that forced people closer together, hurts people and the farmers, etc. And that is one cause that behind some of the violence there. So,
I think if people knew that they could make this positive choice, and
absolutely.
It would have this ripple effect,
mm-hmm.
you know, toward, you know, many people will look at what's happening in Darfur, or they'll look at, you know, Chad or any of these places,
mm-hmm.
and they'll say, well, you know, I don't know what I can do about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's way over there, and I didn't make the choices that led there. Just connecting the dots for people so that they can see that their choices that contribute to climate change, contribute to war and violence, you know, just connecting these dots. I guess that's our
mm-hmm.
job, you know, is to connect these dots and then
mm-hmm.
empower people. You know, I was speaking at a human rights festival, and when I got there, there was a huge banner, and it said, Stop All Wars.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at that banner when I got there, and I thought, Stop All Wars? There's an overwhelming request. It's overwhelming. Most people are going to look at that and
mm-hmm.
say, there's nothing I can do to stop all wars. So when I got up to speak, I said, you know, this looks a little overwhelming to me. I don't know how to stop all wars. I'm
mm-hmm.
guessing you don't know how to stop all wars. But I'm going to ask you to flip the first word and the last word to their opposites. So instead of stop all wars, let's have it be start all peace.
Uh-huh.
And that we can do. I mean, that we can just start right now with
mm-hmm.
every
Absolutely.
Choice we make
mm-hmm.
every day. You know, we have mm-hmm. choices. So
mm-hmm.
I do think that what you're doing is so empowering for people. You know, I want to talk a little bit about sacred duty before we wrap
mm-hmm.
up the wonderful
yeah.
film that
you produced.
By the
way, one quick
produced.
Point. Somebody once pointed out, you know, it's interesting. Look at the word war, W-A-R. Turn it around, and it's R-A-W.
Mm-hmm.
And I often thought if people really moved to raw food diets, maybe not 100%, but to a large extent, that might be a major, major factor. You know, it
yeah.
would cut pollution. It would cut possibly climate change. And it might be
we might have some clear thinking, healthy
clear
people
thinking,
walking
yeah.
around on the planet too.
Right. Okay, but you started to mention.
Oh yeah, I wanted to talk about the film before we
mm-hmm.
we wrap up.
Okay.
You know, it's called Sacred Duty, and in the title, you know, it looks at it's talking about Jewish values, but
mm-hmm.
I'm thinking that, you know, when I watched that film, I thought, this film is good for all faiths, all
mm-hmm.
spiritual paths. And so I guess I'd like to address that a little bit, like what
mm-hmm.
all of these religions and all these spiritual paths have in common. And, you know, it always brings me kind of back to the golden rule, the do unto others as you
mm-hmm.
would have them
Absolutely.
Do unto you, which
right.
there's a version of in pretty much every
Absolutely.
Religion.
Right,
and
right.
all that I feel like we need to do is redefine others. Who is others?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not just people, it's all life. So in making this film, you know, I want you to talk a little bit about
mm-hmm.
who you see as the audience and,
mm-hmm.
you know, what
okay.
was your inspiration for creating this film?
Right. Right, you mentioned other religions. So it's interesting. What spurred me on to produce this was I was at one of those conferences I mentioned before, a summer fest of the North American Vegetarian Society, and there I saw this wonderful film produced by the Christian Vegetarian Association, you know, making these same points that we've been talking about. And at the end, I asked for comments, and I got up and really commended it and said, you know, I just wish we had a similar one for the Jewish Vegetarian Society. And I'm editor of the Jewish Vegetarian of North American newsletter, and I often send out ideas, suggestions, you know, but people are busy. Often I don't get a response. But I put in something about seeing this movie and saying, gee, it would be great if we could have a Jewish vegetarian kind of similar film. And fortunately, I got a response from this wonderful, wonderful person, Lionel Friedberg, who was a multi-award winning, Emmy Award winning producer. And he said, yeah, we've got to do this, and he's going to help us do it. And he did it as a labor of love and dedication, not taking a penny of professional fee, just covers his expenses.
Wow.
His wife is also a professional editor, and she did it also with no fee. So it was really wonderful that he did it, otherwise we just couldn't do it. And I agree that all religions can be involved. I am also the president of the Society of Ethical and Religious Vegetarians, which is a multi-religious group. And as you point out, every religion has the equivalent of a golden rule. Everyone is based on compassion and seeking justice and peace and sharing, etc. So, and thank God we've gotten very good comments and blurbs. By the way, if people go to a sacred duty, the name of the movie.com, they can see the entire movie, and it even has versions with subtitles in Hebrew and many, many other languages. And there's also blurbs there and reviews and questions and answers. And thank God we've gotten very good response, not only from Jews, but from many Christians and people of other religions. So I hope that message will get out, because it talks about the environmental threats, but it also, luckily, just came out after that UN FAO report I mentioned, so it does make the connections between animal-based agriculture and climate change. And we feel the issues are so important that we have given out at least 30,000, maybe 35,000 complimentary DVDs by now. Often when we go to these conferences, we give them out. We try to get it to editors and rabbis and other religious leaders and all, and we made it freely available. It's on YouTube, but the easy address is sacredduty.com.
It's such a powerful film. You know, if there's anyone listening who has not seen this film, or if you picked up one of those complimentary copies and it's gathering dust on your shelf, pull it off the shelf, watch it, and pass it around, because it's so powerful.
And possibly set up a showing. Yeah, so following up on that, I hope everybody listening to this will consider themselves a spokesperson for this cause, because, as I say, it's not just an individual choice. The fate of humanity is involved. You know, it's a societal imperative that there be a major, major shift in plant-based diets. So I hope everybody will take the initiative and contact religious leaders, contact politicians, educators, everybody, talk to your friends, neighbors, write letters to the editor, call in to talk shows, etc. Do everything possible, of course, in a very respectful way. Get educated. There's so many wonderful books and videos out there. I hope what we've been discussing will be helpful, but so many others that show the realities of factory farms and also discuss the many benefits of plant-based diets.
Great, great. Richard, how can folks get a hold of you?
Okay, well, here's an email address, president@JewishVeg, one word, Jewish followed by VEG.com. And also invite people to go to a website where I have 140 articles and about 25 podcasts of my talks and interviews. And at that website, it has the complete text of my book, Judaism and Vegetarianism, and also another book, Judaism and Global Survival, which encompasses vegetarianism but discusses other things needed for moving our imperiled planet to a sustainable path. So I hope people will go there and feel free to use the articles, build on them, etc., and help spread the very, very important message that a shift to plant-based diets is essential to avoid impending climate catastrophe that the world is heading toward, and to really shift our imperiled planet to a sustainable path.
Thank you so much, Richard. This is Ray Secor, and I've been speaking to Richard Schwartz, and I am so grateful for all that you do, Richard. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for all you do and for this wonderful discussion. It was really a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure to be with you, too. Thanks, Richard.
All right. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
You, too. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to another presentation of the Vegan Vegetarian Solutions for a Sustainable Environment podcast. For a free subscription to the podcast, please use the RSS feed found by clicking the vegetarian link at h2opodcast.com or by emailing nomeat@h2opodcast.com. Music by the band Cats in the Hats, and provided by the Podshow PodSafe Music Network, music.podshow.com. We'll be right back.